listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds. Tonight on Right On Radio, Annie talks with Linda Lagarde Grover. She is the author of the recently released book, Gichigami Hearts, as well as award-winning books of fiction, poetry, and essays. She is a member of the Bois Fort Band of Ojibwe and Professor Emeritus of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, Liz speaks with Teresa Dovelpage about her
latest Havana mystery, Death Under Persides. Dovelpage was born in Havana, Cuba, and her PhD in Latin American literature from the University of New Mexico. She's the author of 13 works of fiction, 3 plays, and is the winner of the Raison de la Victoria Award. She currently lives in New Mexico. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
All right, so this is Annie Harview, and I'm here with Linda Lagarde Grover, the author of Gichigami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Masabikong. She is faculty emeritus of UMD and member of the Bois Fort Ojibwe. Hi, Linda. Can you hear us okay?
I can hear fine. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. It's really great to have you here. So for those who haven't read this book yet, it is a recent release. Would you mind briefly describing what the book is about? And if you'd like, read a little passage of your choice.
Let's see. Well, Gichigami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Masabikong. Gichigami is an Ojibwe word, and it means the Great Lake. It refers to Great Lake Superior. Mm-hmm. So Lake Superior up here on the Duluth is on the tip is Gichigami Anishinaabe, the one in this region. And Stories and Histories from Masabikong. Masabikong is another Ojibwe word, and in English it would translate to the place of the giants. And it's in my book anyway, it is referring to the terrain around here, the very large rock formations that overlook Duluth. Mm-hmm. So it's a mix of, it's part memoir, mm-hmm. it's part history mm-hmm. of the Duluth and Arrowhead region, but also a history of the great migration of the Ojibwe people hundreds of years ago from the East Coast up by Newfoundland mm-hmm. up to where we live today. Mm-hmm. It also includes, this book has, it has some family stories, some stories about Duluth and the region here of the formation of the reservation lands and where people ended up and where we live today. There's some fiction in here, some creative fiction, kind of like fictionalized stories. Mm-hmm. There is some poetry. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole lot in this book. Mm-hmm. So I think I'll read a little bit from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Where am I going to start here? Sorry.
No problem.
All right. Part of a massive expanse of gabbro rock that extends southwest of Duluth and follows the north shore of Lake Superior into Canada, the point of rocks divides the city of Duluth in half. The area around Duluth has been known by Ojibwe words that describe the terrain. Mm-hmm. One of these is Onigamasing, the place of the small portage, which refers to the 5-mile-long sandbar not far from the point of rocks. Another then is Masabikong, the place of the giants. Standing on top of those walls of gabbro or looking up at the mass of rocks and trees from the valleys and lakeshore, we are standing among the giants. In 1838, newlyweds Josepha Susan Niganagijic and Gabriel Ogama LaVerge traveled from La Pointe, Wisconsin on Madeline Island to Fond du Lac, the Ojibwe settlement next to the American Fur Post on the St. Louis River in Minnesota. Their first child, Angelique, was born in 1839 at the Fond du Lac settlement in sight of the Gabbro Ridge that was there long before Duluth or a state of Minnesota, before the lands of the Minnesota Arrowhead were lost under the terms of the 1854 treaty. Mm-hmm. That baby girl lived to be an old woman. Angelique's children and grandchildren scattered under federal removals and relocations and became part of the Boys Fort, Fond du Lac, and Grand Portage bands. She died in the West End neighborhood in sight of the western side of the Point of Rocks and is buried at the Park Hill Cemetery next to her husband, a Civil War veteran. During her lifetime, Angelique had moved from one end of Duluth to the other, never far from the Gabbro Ridge and the Point of Rocks. We, the descendants, are of this land and story, and this land and story are of us. We are honored to live in this place of the giants.
Thank you so much. That was such an excellent way to start off the interview. This is not an interview by any means about me, but I am from Duluth. I really love the sense of continuity that this book brings, where it delves so much into your life and the history of your family, but additionally to the people that have lived in this region for huge swaths of generations before and after us. And additionally, the way the land figures truly outdate all of us and stand watch over all of us. You've written several books before. About notably seasons, other things. What brought about this book and how it relates to your previous work?
I think this relates to all of the work that I've done so far. Mm-hmm. I have three works of fiction, and a book of poetry and another book of essays called Onagamacing, Seasons of an Ojibwe Year. Mm-hmm. My research has been on effects of federal Indian policy, especially education policy, on the lives of children. I started out with boarding school research about Indian boarding schools. Mm-hmm. And from there, you know, of course, nothing operates alone. It's always linked to something else. And so my research on effects of federal policies, but also on the survival and the, you know, and many times the thriving and the sheer tenacity and the love of life of the Ojibwe people is interwoven in everything I've done. And so I think that Gitche-Gami Hearts then is just kind of the next step in what I'm trying to do, to tell a story about what it was, how it is today, how we hope it'll be in the future.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, all of those things interweave so neatly in the book, despite the broad range that it covers. And as you write about Duluth, early in the book, you made an observation that stuck with me throughout, that American English usually names a place after a person, like Duluth was a French-American fur trade and kind of dude, while native languages will usually name a place after a natural feature. As you wrote about Duluth as yourself, what was your process as you chose the section topics and the key themes that kind of structure the parts of your book?
They kind of happened on their own. What would the word be? Organically.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring in the history and the history that was written down, but also the histories that came through many ages in oral tradition, and you know, they do intersect with written history at a point. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to have a flow, that sense of time before and time now. Mm-hmm. And with that, what does it mean to be Anishinaabe Ojibwe? And what do the very old stories and the teachings that have been passed down for, you know, against all odds by generations before us, how do they work? How can we honor them and do right by them in contemporary life and providing also for the future?
Absolutely. And to kind of continue on the theme of the combination of history with the personal and oral storytelling specifically, in the book, you refer to the tapestry of knowledge. I really liked that phrase that makes up oral storytelling. And how that can look like the combination of one's personal story style and then kind of essential points that make up the essence of what that story is. When you as an author were working on retelling some traditional stories, like the stories of Nana Bujo and Nokomis that are in this book, what goes into your process as you tell those to a broad audience?
Nanabuju is, he is in many of the stories of this region, and he's a great spirit hero of the Ojibwe people. And he was raised and taught by his grandmother, Nokomis. She taught him everything she knew. So how to pass on some of the knowledge that comes through these stories, there are many stories. I don't think that I'm sure that there is no single person who knows them all. There are some people who know a few or one or a lot, but altogether, I kind of think of it as a tapestry too of a story that is timeless. We don't know when these things happened or how long ago they happened, but mm-hmm. We're living our lives against the backdrop of those teachings. And mm-hmm. I believe that in our everyday lives, we are reliving aspects of those teachings also. Mm-hmm. And so that was in my mind as I brought in and referenced a couple of the stories that are especially, you know, dear and meaningful to me.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever, when you were working on a story, reconnect with someone who had told you it orally in the past, or were you focusing more specifically on memory? Just curious about your process.
When a story is shared, mm-hmm. it is from something that a person has heard many times before. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I certainly recalled hearing these things and, you know, a number of times in the past, and understanding that, you know, our role then is to, you know, be very respectful and pass them on in the proper way. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, we hear a lot of, often we hear the phrase oral tradition, mm-hmm. when we're talking about the passing of knowledge, of how to act, of how the world came to be the way it is. We hear that term oral history, but, you know, I've come to think of it as gotten hung up on that concept, which is English language. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that is actually really doing justice to the passing on of knowledge in this way. Mm. And so what is oral tradition? I've wondered, something that is more of a colonial term, mm. that has kind of bound us into something narrower than what these stories were meant to be. And so in writing, though, mm-hmm. one must take very special care to do justice to not the stories themselves, to the beings who are included in the stories, and also in the people who shared those stories with you in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I just want to touch one more time, since I'm so interested in what you're saying. I just want to touch on the idea of kind of a colonialist or like a European Western idea of oral tradition limiting what it can be. How do you feel like in writing down a story, you are at all limiting what it can be? Or do you feel like by retelling it in English and trying to make, do you feel like that alters from the, pardon me, I'm having trouble articulating this.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it alters the, I guess, the tools of language that you have to speak with? Or I'm very interested in that concept, because it seems to me like oral tradition was always presented to me as just like rote memorization of something. But this is something that was taught to mm-hmm. me by other people of Western and European descent, and not necessarily like something I was told by people who grew up learning through oral traditions.
You know, it goes far beyond learning by rote. by ROTE wrote. Mm-hmm. It goes far beyond that because it involves the taking in of knowledge and events and the proper sequencing of things. Mm-hmm. And so in sharing these stories, there are particular things that happen at certain points in these stories, and those must be included. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone who shares a story has their own way of speaking and their own way of presenting mm-hmm. this knowledge. But it is not, I think it's much more than listening and memorizing the words. It goes far beyond that because we are passing on beliefs. The ways of being, our very existence mm-hmm. is what is being shared when a story is shared. So it's a great honor to have a story shared. Mm-hmm. And with that, then there's a great obligation, to listen with your ears, but mm-hmm. also with your very being, your soul, and giving a great deal of thought to what you're hearing.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That really clarified and gives me a lot to think about. A part of the book that largely pertained or more closely pertained to your own family's history that I found so interesting was the stand, I believe it was called, on the North Shore.
Oh, the tourist stand. Yes,
the tourist uh-huh. stand. Yeah. So mm-hmm. There's a discussion that follows from that about Native art and tourist art and how you encounter an axe in a museum and you're not sure, like, was this made to sell to people who aren't necessarily Native as a gift, or is this something that someone was using for survival? And I think it was excellent food for thought for art as a tourist commodity and whether that is inherently, I don't know, inauthentic, or if that's actually a very authentic because it's a space for the creativity and survival of a people who were being marginalized by people who had moved in more recently, making the idea of them being inauthentic entirely negated because they're what that people needed at that time. And I was just wondering that if, as you wrote that piece and as you had those conversations and learned that family history about the tourist stand, did your views on Native art or the conversation within your social circle about Native art as a commodity change over time? And is that something that kind of continues to ebb and flow or?
Well, first of all, I believe that what we would call tourist art is, mm-hmm. I mean, it is Native art.
Yeah.
And so, in the old days, mm-hmm. During the times of, like, I know the painters of the Renaissance and stuff, I mean, people were sculpting and painting things that were going to be hung on the wall or put on a stand. Mm-hmm. And that is not how Indigenous art was expressed long ago. Mm-hmm. And so nowadays, in more contemporary times, certainly we see, great Indian sculptors and great Native painters, artists who make just, art that will be looked at. Mm-hmm. I believe that, commoditized art for Native people started after after Europeans started coming in here in this part of the country, the fur trade, especially mm-hmm. when it was necessary for people in the fur trade to be able to access some of the tools and means of survival. I mean, the clothing, the shelter, the canoes mm-hmm. Around here. And so with that trading of goods, mm-hmm. for not necessarily cash money at that time, I think that was the beginning of what you might call a commoditized type of art. Mm-hmm. So is the object itself art? Certainly it is, whether mm-hmm. a canoe has decoration and embellishment or not, it is art. Is a hide scraper mm-hmm. art, and of course it is. The type of art that was sold in in the tourist business, probably started, you know, it was certainly growing, but it really hit its heyday in like the 19 teens, 20s, 30s, 40s. Mm-hmm. And that was art created, objects created specifically for sale. And yeah, it did certainly have a lot to do with survival in an economy that had, you know, moved more into being part of a cash economy. Mm-hmm. But my cousin Bob Swanson is really knowledgeable about these things. And as a boy, as an elder now, mm-hmm. too, he still makes many things that are sold for cash money, yeah. some to Native people, some to non-Native people. Mm-hmm. And when Bob and I were talking, you know, he's kind of a funny guy, kind of a humorous guy. And so I was asking, well, you know, is there a line somewhere? Because I was trying to learn mm-hmm. so much. And he said, well, did an Indian make it? Well, then it's Indian art. Mm-hmm. And that was quite funny. So in that article, mm-hmm. when there are stories about things that were made from things that were in the dump, mm-hmm. from dump runs, from the throwaways of larger American society, mm-hmm. that was really a traditional, truly Anishinaabe way of acting around, you know, with interacting with the world around you, because mm-hmm. what is there mm-hmm. is there for you to perhaps utilize mm-hmm. and to make something beautiful or useful or enjoyable. Mm-hmm. That's whether it's something that came from the dump or something that came from a walk into the woods or along the lake shore, mm-hmm. the concept really is the same. And so my cousin Bob, as he was talking, he said, it's creative living. And then he said, and it's fun.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
That's so excellent. Thank you. As someone with literally a public education in Duluth, a big value of this book to me was the way the combination of clearly the historical research you've done, in addition to stories of your family, dispelling the idea that relocation acts and oppressive boarding schools and other methods that could be broadly categorized as colonialism, are only a couple generations past, and that many survivors of these events walk among us. What do you recommend as both a researcher and educator of this topic as productive ways to engage with and make positive changes for the future away from these really tragic, oppressive forms?
I think it's, always important to know the history. Mm-hmm. and to, because that helps us to understand a little better how we came to where we are today. And that's for everybody, mm-hmm. for Native people and non-Native people, is to, to study the history, read, or, there are excellent movies, documentaries, and mm-hmm. and just regular movies that I think can be helpful in this. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to ever like try to erase the past mm-hmm. or to rewrite the past. Mm-hmm. It's it happened. A lot of it was really, really difficult mm-hmm. and continues to be difficult and mm-hmm. follows us today. Mm-hmm. And even for Native people who don't really, know a whole lot of stuff about this, it is still there. Mm-hmm. And so to know that, to give things a great deal of thought. And I know the way, in Ojibwe tradition, a person who thinks a lot mm-hmm. and doesn't jump right in is, a child is, people think, well, perhaps he or she is on their way to wisdom by being a person who thinks a lot about these things.
Thank you.
It's with us today. It's hard. It's very hard. And, in the last year or so with news on, everything's all about the media now. That's where we get so much about what's happening in the world. But, finally, people learning a little bit about, you know, our education past in the, you know, institutionalized education mm-hmm. is something that, you know, I think it's a good thing that people are learning about this. But I think in learning about it, you know, mm-hmm. also think and know that there is so much to the story, that it goes far beyond what any of us really know.
Yeah, thank you so much. That definitely gives motivation to research more, learn more, develop that awareness. We're running out of time, so I'm just going to wrap up with one more quick question. You talked towards the end of the book about the Anishinaabe value of accepting ambiguity and contrast as part of the big picture balance. Mm-hmm. I loved that. And I found that. So this is a great, an excellent essay collection that combines the personal and the more global. But it uses such a different way of thinking than the very immediate personal way of thinking that's common in a lot of mainstream essay collections that I've read over the past few years. And I just wanted to ask how leaving room for ambiguity informs your creative practice, including your writing.
That type of what we might call creativity is present in everybody, I think. And so having an acceptance and an understanding of that's the way things are. I think all of us with that, I think that gives us almost a permission to explore and examine, to observe, and then maybe if we feel like it, write something or sew something or make something. Mm-hmm. That's what I think.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That's a really great way to think and a really great place to end. Everyone, this has been Linda Lagarde Grover, the author of Gichigami Hearts, which collects stories from and histories from Masabi Kong and the Duluth area. Thank you so much for joining us, Linda.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Teresa, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, great. This is Liz Olds, and we're speaking with Teresa Doublepage today. Her new book, which comes out today, I believe, is called Death Under the Pleiades. Pyrades, sorry. And let's start with a little synopsis of what the book is about, and then a reading, if you could.
Okay, sure. Thank you, Liz. This is the Pyrades. I'm not even sure myself sometimes how to pronounce the title, but last I heard was this on the Pyrades. So I'm going to go with that. And if the listeners correct me, bueno. So this is my fourth mystery of the series Havana Mysteries, all published by Soho Crime. And it takes place in Havana and Miami, but mostly in Havana. And the novel starts with a very happy surprise. Cuban-born Mercedes and her American husband, Nolan, get a couple of free cruise tickets to Cuba. Qué nice, no?
Yes.
But the moment they board the ship, things start looking a little suspicious. Because Mercedes sees several people that she had met 10 years ago in Havana. And it's like too much of a coincidence, she thinks, that one of her former professors and the literary agent of her former boyfriend, El Hombre de Su Vida, no, the guy that she really loved, are there too. And then things get really suspicious when one of these ghosts from the past disappears. Then after the cruise arrives in Havana, well, we follow Mercedes around the city as she revisits her past, and then people continue to vanish. So that's the best summary I can come up with right now. And I can tell you, I also take the readers on a tour of Cuba, you know, and of places that I know quite well, like the University of Havana, where I was a student myself, and more touristy spots like Old Havana and Cathedral Square.
Okay. Do you have a reading, or should we just dive right into your...
Yes.
Okay, why don't we go with the reading?
I have a reading here. Perfect. I start with the beginning of the book. The cruise ship Narwhal, all 12 decks of her, towered above the terminal building. It had a festive air, with the hull painted white. and bright ribbons of red, yellow, and green splashed all over. From the distance, it looked like a giant tropical bird that had inexplicably landed on water. August in Miami was, as usual, 94 degrees. It's a devilish mix of heat and humidity that made you want to crawl inside a refrigerator. The Nautilus instructions said to be at Terminal B before noon, but it was well past one and the line to enter the building wasn't moving. It was worse than being in an airport for Dio. Then I remembered that we had no right to complain. After all, we had gotten the cruise for free. I was still scratching my head about the whole thing. It all began when a young woman showed up at Pretty and Pampered, the pet grooming salon where I worked part-time, asking for me. She looked like a teenager, but dressed professionally in a beige suit, and introduced herself as a Nautilus representative. I was getting ready to give a summer cut to Standard Poodle when she presented me with an embossed envelope and cooed, "Congratulations, Miss Ivy, you have just won 2 cruise tickets to Havana." Now, I was born and raised in Havana. After marrying Nolan in 2008, I have returned many times to visit my grandmother, but never thought of taking a cruise back. And now, in July 2017, sailing to Cuba was the last thing on my mind. "Pass one what?" I asked. The poodle took advantage of my surprise to get away and hide under a shed. "A couple of tickets. About the Narwhal, our most popular ship. The cruise departing on August 10th. Nautilus Cruise Line had started to offer short cruises that included Cuba in their itinerary, she explained. They were carrying out their biggest ever promotional campaign with many giveaways. I was one of the lucky winners. Cool, huh? What that chick didn't say was how and where I had signed up for the raffle or whatever it was that I had won. I used to enter sweepstakes that promised everything from $500 a week for life to a grand prize of $1 million or a weekend in Paris. But that was a long time ago. It had finally dawned on me that most were a waste of time, if not outright scam. I didn't know how these Nautilus people found me either. But I guess everybody's information is online nowadays. Besides, the idea of winning something, anything, was appealing. I kept my mouth shut and accepted the gift.
That was Teresa Doublepage, a wonderful reading, the beginning of the book Death Under the Parades. Let's start with the story of Havana. You clearly, it is deeply ingrained in your psyche, and you love it, it seems like, and it becomes kind of a character in the book in and of itself. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your love for that city and for Cuba.
Of course. Well, I was born in Havana and I lived there until I was 30 years old. So it's my city. It's when I think of, you know, home, pues es La Habana, you know. Even though I love where I live now, I live in New Mexico, and I love New Mexico, too. I have found a second home here, but Havana is where I grew up, so it always appears in all my books as a character. And now that you mentioned it, was, it's true, it's very dead. Havana is a character because it breathes in the book, you know, and everything happens there. I really don't know much about all that parts of Cuba, so I keep myself centered in Havana when I write for fear of making an embarrassing mistake. And I grew up in Central Havana, which is kind of in the middle of the city. But this other person takes place more in Miramar, which is a kind of a nicer suburb. That's where the protagonist used to live before she moved to Miami. But then, of course, in the story, she visits several places and one of the places, La Quinta de los Molinos, is a botanical park. And are close, very close to where I used to live and where my mother still lives in Central Havana. And that place plays a very important role in the story. So I tried to describe it in as many details as I could. And actually, when I went to Cuba almost 2 years ago, I took a lot of pictures of La Quinta de los Molinos, the botanical park, to make sure that I was describing it right.
These books, the Havana Mystery Series, are all standalone, and yet they also are of a piece with each other. And I'm wondering which characters follow through the books and which are new in each book and what each of the books is about before this one.
Okay, the first three have the same detectives in common. Padrino is the Santeria practitioner that has become a detective after retiring from the Cuban police. And the other one is Marlene Martinez. She's a former Cuban cop that in the third novel is in Miami. So these three books, Death Comes In Through the Kitchen, Queen of Bones, and Death of a Telenovela Star, these three are the first, actually, the Havana Mystery Series as such, because they have these two characters, Padrino, the Santero detective, and Marlene. Now, this one, Death Under the Purses, it's a little different in the sense that there is no need of a detective in the story. So Padrino and Marlene only appears as the owner of a bakery in Miami. The bakery is called La Vaqueria Cubana. But she's not, she doesn't play the role of the detective anymore. So all of the books can be read by themselves. They are standalone. But this one is the beginning of another series, maybe, because after this one, we have the second one, which Mercedes has to go back to Cuba to look for her mother.
It sounds like Mercedes is going to continue. Would you talk a little bit about her story and her dreams and hopes?
Let me just say something. It's funny because several of the reviews that I have read describe Mercedes as an unsympathetic character. And it surprised me because she's actually based on several people that I know in real life and some part of myself, and I've never seen my friends as unsympathetic. So it's kind of, oh, maybe I included too much information that people, but, or maybe it's because I just accept people as they are. But anyway, Mercedes was born in the 90s, in 89 in Cuba, and she grew up during the special period, the 90s, where things became very difficult, very hard in Cuba, after the collapse of communism in Europe. So Mercedes used to kind of find her way around the best she can, and she marries this American professor who takes her to Miami first, and they move to Gainesville. And so in the book is how she has to adapt to a totally different culture, and that's also something that I try to reflect in Death Under the Purses, is that this process, the immigrant experience for somebody that it's not the usual, you know, immigrant experience starting from scratch, but even for somebody that came to a home, established place, it is also difficult. So her dreams, Mercedes wants to become part of American life, but of course she still has her Havana roots very deep, and that's all part of the plot. And also, her mother is an American, but she has disappeared. In the second book, I still don't have a title, but I start with that. Mercedes comes back to Cuba to look for her mother, to find out where she may be.
And I particularly loved her relationship with her grandmother. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that relationship and also the concept of of extended family, and I'm wondering how that goes in Cuba, if there's extended family situations there.
Yes, mamina, I especially my own grandmother, esa sí, la abuela, ¿verdad? Sí, las abuelas, grandmothers, grandparents, you know, are very important in our concept of the family, because in most cases, there are three generations living under the same roof in Cuba, and no, there are no many possibilities of moving to a new house when you start a family. So in this particular case with Mercedes, Mamina was the one who raised her because Mercedes' father died and her mother disappeared. So Mamina is actually the one that takes care of her through her childhood and comes back every year to visit her. Well, that's something that happens a lot in our Cuban families, no? La relación tan fuerte, this strong relationship with the grandparents and the extended family and the idea of everybody living together. So, yeah, that was something else that I reflected, not only with Mercedes, but also with her friends in Havana.
Right, right. So the title refers to a very beautiful thing that I've never heard of before. Could you talk about the parades and what they are and how often they show up?
Yeah, the meteor shower. Oh, it is a beautiful, beautiful meteor shower. Is it really? I'm not even sure that my description does justice to it because I used to see it in town, where I used to live before I moved to Hobbs, and the sky is so clear at night, and it takes place once a year in August 10th to the 13th or so. It's always around the same time, and then you can see these beautiful meteors going through the sky, and sometimes they have different colors. It's really spectacular. So I used it.
Well, I was wondering if we can see them up here, if you can only see them further south. I live pretty far north in Minneapolis, so.
I think they are visible mostly anywhere, but it depends on the conditions of the sky, because if it is too cloudy or something up there, I don't know. But here in Cuba, we can see it very easy because there is no light pollution.
Right.
In the countryside. No, hombre, no, pues ahí estamos. You can see the stars every night. And in Miramar, where Mercedes grew up, pues it was it was a light show whenever it happened. And in this case, where I showed them looking at them from the cruise ship or around the harbor. And yeah, in Havana, you can still get a pretty good view of the meteor shower. Because in the summer month, the sky is super clear.
And how did you come up with the title? How did you draw that into the title? It seems to be a metaphor for part of what's going on in the book.
It's a little bit of a metaphor because the meteor shower is actually the ghost of a comet. It's the comet that passes and just left behind of this debris. And that's what we actually see when the Earth encounters in the orbit of the Earth, it encounters the debris of the comet. So it's not the comet itself, it's just the particles that it has left behind that we can see. And so it kind of functions like a metaphor of the relationship that Mercedes had with one of her former boyfriends, well, el hombre de su vida, the man of her life, still present as a ghost, you know, in her life, even though they broke up a long time ago.
We're talking with Teresa Doublepage.
And I really like the perfect anyway.
It sounds beautiful. We're talking with Teresa Doublepage about her book, Death Under the Paradise. I understand it's coming out today, or it came out yesterday?
Well, I think today, yes.
Well, that's
today
exciting.
Today is publication day. I'm so happy.
Yay, that's really exciting. That's really exciting. So check that out. And we're going to talk a little bit about your plays now. I'm wondering what your connection is with the theater and how you came to write plays.
Well, my first play was actually part of a class project when I was a graduate student at the University of New Mexico. And the professor of Estudios Nuevo Mexicanos, like New Mexican Studies, gave us the option of writing an essay or something creative. Dije, no, hombre, no, pues algo creativo, ¿verdad? Prefer to write something creative. And then I wrote about La Llorona, the wailing woman. This myth is very popular, well, not only here in New Mexico, but in Cuba, we have our own version of La Llorona, and of course in Mexico and in many countries. So I used the myth of La Llorona, and a Cuban who lived in New Mexico and kind of encounters La Llorona during her life in Albuquerque. So I was inspired by this local, but not really local, myth of the wailing woman. And that was my first play. And I didn't know what to do with it. And I sent it to Aguijón Theater in Chicago. I said, well, a ver qué pasa, ¿no? Just to see what happens. And they actually staged it. And I was like, wow, that? Wow. Then after that, I wrote another theater play, Hasta que el mortgage nos separe. We'll say, until mortgage do us depart. That had to do more with the mortgage crisis in 2008 and all that. So, and after that, I'm still working on a third play, and I have a lot of fun writing plays anyway. Even some of my novels, I started as, you know, the skeleton of the novel is a play, and then I put more flesh in them.
You have written both in Spanish and English novels, and I'm wondering how you decide which language to use and so on.
Well, it's easier for me, of course, to write in Spanish, but these novels, the mystery series, just came to me in English for some strange reason. I don't know why, but like the first one, Death Comes In Through the Kitchen, even the title, La Muerte Entra Por La Cocina, it came to me in English. And the story also. So that's how they flow through me. And sometimes story comes in Spanish, and hard as I try, I cannot put it in English. So I don't think I really decided. It's just how the stories come to me. And of course, recently, I have been reading a lot more in English. So it's easier now that the flow gets going in English and not in Spanish. But you notice I always put some things in Spanish there, yes. Because, like, why not?
Yes. Well, I am sorry to say that we're almost out of time. I just want to ask a last kind of question of how people can find you on the web and how they can contact you.
Ah, muchas gracias. They can look at my website, teresadovalpage.com, or, well, that's the one in Spanish, or Tere, T-E-R-E, dovalpage.com in English, and also my website at the Soho Press. I have a page in Soho Press website, and look at it there, and my email address is my last name, dovalpage@aol.com.
Great. Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you. We've been talking to Teresa Doublepage about her book, Death Under the Persades. And we have, it is today's, the publication date. So we're very excited for you, Teresa. And that's about all we have time for. Thank you very much for spending part of your evening with us.
Thank you, Liz. Muchas gracias for inviting me. I have enjoyed our conversation a lot. Gracias.
De nada. Thank you very much. And now this.
You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harview. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, Linda Lagarde Grover and Teresa Doublepage, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right On Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio, plus listen to recent episodes on our podcast, which you can find on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, anywhere you can find podcasts. Now stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.
Thank you.